This is Fresh Air on 91 FM, and it's 28 minutes to 5 o'clock. Well, one of the most talked about subgenres of TV advertising, which they want to do a part 3 on, is the local ad, which stars the owner of the business being advertised. And with me are two men who have become well-known throughout the Delaware Valley for their commercials. With me is Ben Crass of Crass Brothers and Aaron Levin of Aaron Levin Galleries. And we're going to talk about why they've done their own ads and how being on TV has affected their business and their image. I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air. And just in case any of our audience, any people who are listening, have not already connected your names with your commercials, for the purposes of connecting those two, I'd like to ask you each to do just a few seconds of how they'd hear you on TV. Ben Crass?
We started off, if you didn't buy your clothes from Crass Brothers, you was robbed.
Aaron Levin?
Aaron Levin is having a sale, an art sale, a fine arts artist art sale. Magnificent paintings and beautiful frames, reduced to $49.95, frame included. Saturday and Sunday only. Don't miss it.
And just in case you think public radio is suddenly having commercials, that's not the case. We just wanted you to be able to hear what the commercials are that we'll be talking about and how these two men sound on television. Unfortunately, we can't present your pictures as well. Well, why did you decide, Ben Crass, you've been doing it a long time, why did you decide to do ads for your own business?
When I started, which is a spell ago, there was no such thing as a 10-second commercial. It was always 20, 30, or 60. And I figured that 10 seconds ought to be a ripe thing for the agencies throughout the United States. It was unheard of by everybody I spoke to, and of course, I only do 7 seconds. 3 seconds is a live tag, you know. And when the people who I was going to put on the station, NBC at that time, said, you can't sell in 7 seconds, impossible. I said, well, I'll take a jaunt and a try. And then I signed up for 26 weeks. And, of course, the commercial I just finished was the first 10-second commercial in the United States. And it ran and it was publicized and was saturated on Channel 3. And later on, as you know, it went through all the stations throughout the TV audience. It sold, it grasped, it was repeated from the Delaware Valley of one place to another. So I had to go forth and go further, and it proved that it was the right thing to do. And I did it.
Did anyone tell you at that time that it was foolish for you to do an ad for yourself, that you should get a professional TV person come on and do it?
I don't think anybody said it that way. They said it's too, some would say it's too fast. Some would say it's, well, most of them said it was, you know, they repeated the cliche or the phraseology, you was robbed if you didn't go. You know, that's, it just took off. And when something takes off, the bottom line is still success. Repeat what the man says and they go over.
Aaron Levin, why did you decide to do a commercial for your own place?
For the original idea was to have somebody to talk to. An art gallery is generally a very formidable place for most people to walk into, and most people are afraid of it. The idea of doing a commercial and being seen live or being seen on tape, as the case may be, was, hey, if they see somebody and they recognize somebody, hey, I know who that is. That's the guy on television. They'll say, let's go in there. I know who it is. And you've already broken the ice before they've set foot in the door. And I think that was the big motivating force. Get them through the door and without fear. Once that happened, then all the rest of the ice melted away. That was really the reason that's what instituted it.
Did you sit down and say to yourself, now, what kind of image do I want to present on TV? And Should I be funny or serious, hard sell or soft sell? Should I wear makeup or not? Should I practice my speech? Ben Crass, did you go through all that, or did you?
Well,
you
when
just
you're
knew
on television,
you
Terry, you must wear a certain covering for your face. I mean, because it shines under those heavy lights. As far as an image, the main image is what you say and what you, the ending of your particular commercial. If it grasps on, does it have character, does it make people think? It's what the bottom line is after you pitch. Anybody can say anything they please, but if it don't go anywhere, it's just an ordinary piece of sterile material that means nothing. The main thing is say something. If they repeat it, they think about it, they come and patronize you, then you know you're on the right track. That's my story.
Mm. When it happened to me, the art establishment, as it were, said, oh, it couldn't be done. There's no way. You're going to take something as formidable as an art gallery and try to do something about it in 10 seconds? Forget it. It'll never happen, so on and so forth. I just felt that as far as the image, if I try to keep an art gallery image, I would be zeroing in on a very, very small percentage of people. And so what I did, or what I tried to do, was to keep that as wide a latitude as possible. You might call it a shotgun effect. Let it go as far as it can and just see what happens. Sure, it's a gamble. No question about it. But thank goodness, and this speaks for everybody in the TV industry, I think that it proved to be an absolute success. I don't know how I would be able to continue in the gallery business without television.
Did the person who produced the commercial in the studio or the agency that you went through, I don't know how you worked it, ever try to talk you out of it and say, look, you're not a professional?
Yes. But again, I had to stick to the idea that if it was not me, or if it were not me that actually did the commercial, then the very idea that I was trying to promulgate would go down the drain. Namely that, hey, I know him. I've seen him. They can walk in now and either say, hey, I've seen you on TV, or I know you. The ice is broken before the door is open.
Then, Chris, how did people react to you differently after you started being on TV doing your spots?
Why are you talking about being a celebrity? Or is that, what are you driving to, Terry? You mean, or is it that we're doing something that doesn't or isn't represented in the retail market or stuff? How do you feel?
Well, I think that once you're on TV and once people are used to looking you at you on TV, that they respond to you differently when they meet you in person because they've seen that image, they've... You know, TV confers something on you that you can only get by being on TV.
You know, Terry, at the beginning, as I told you, it was tough. I don't know how many people, but throughout the United States, I think everybody that I know of have gone into 10 seconds, which never was done before. It's unheard of. Even, I think, Aaron is the same.
That's right.
He would have gone on if it wasn't for 10
seconds.
Absolutely. And then they say to you, how did you do it? How do they remember? And I say, well, have an action at the end of every commercial you do. Make them remember that it's a little slapstick, yet not too slapstick. Make it a little sterile, not too sterile, though. Have a little fun in it. Bring out the product and hit it and saturate it throughout all your time you're doing it in. At the present time, what do you do, like Aaron says, when they come to the store or if you go out to the various places like I do a lot, all you do is give out autographs. All you do is stop and shake hands. And the first thing they say, where'd you get your suit from? You know, the old cliche, yeah. And they mention another store to try to, you know, bring you down to, for the fun of it, of course. But like I say, if you have a something that's a tremendous punchline in the television industry and you can come up with new eras of thought all the time, like I did something... that frightened the people. In fact, it was written up in, I think, 13 advertising agencies beside TV Guide. One of the funeral directors gave me a coffin, and I sat in it, and I laid in it, and I said, if you got to go, go in the Crash Brothers suit. I laid back dead. Well, I got, oh, did I get flick. In fact, three of the TV stations, the majors wouldn't run it, and the UHFs did. But after they ran it and they saw what was grasping, they all pitched in. They went for it because they got a little more excited that, of our times, we're running a different channel. We're being more elastic about everything we do. It's not just this hat is made of genuine felt. No way. We're doing something with more progress in our commercialism, something that makes sense and yet gives you a little fun and jive other than plain pitch is the word. You're pitching. That's all you're doing.
Terry, in Ben Crass, you have a pioneer. Do you realize that?
Did you do your spots because you'd known his were successful?
No, I didn't know at that particular time. I didn't know that they were successful or not successful. But I realized that if something could be done in 10 seconds and was strictly a matter of dollars and cents, the 10-second spot would be less than the 30- or 60-second spot. And the amount of money that we had to put into it was very, very limited. And but it worked. That's the whole, that as Ben said, that's the bottom line. It worked.
So do people ask for your autograph?
Oh, there, of course. There's a certain amount of egocentricism involved there. You can't help it. The box has a magic all of its own. And I'm not talking strictly from a business sense. I'm talking from a personal sense. You find yourself in a single position or not being married. The idea of being on the tube is better than an ad in Philadelphia Magazine. It has tremendous social implications, and you can't help but enjoy that. Of course, it's an ego trip. It didn't start out that way. I certainly didn't think of it that way. It started out as strictly a business thing. But in the years that I've been on, of course, it has had an effect.
So when someone meets like a say someone who's on TV because they're in a soap opera or they sing or dance or something, they can ask them about their act. What do people ask you when they meet you?
Do you really have that many paintings? Are they really as low as that? Or are you kidding? And the whole idea is this. A question has been raised. If a question has been raised, there's only one way you're going to be able to answer the question. You've got to come to the gallery. It's as simple as that.
Ben Kress, what do people ask you when they meet you as they're asking for your autograph?
Do you have your new stuff in? Did the spring come in? Did the fall came in? You got all sizes? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Are you going to be there? Well, what day you're coming? Whatever day they say, I'll be there. No, just truthfully, everybody wants to come over and meet with someone that's in the TV tube. And they, sooner or later, you know, there's 8 million people as we've drew a conclusion in the Delaware Valley, and they claim through the television audience that Kress Brothers get about 8 million people since the time they started in business. Of course, I wasn't always with them, but for the time I've been in, I must have met better than 4 to 5 million people in that store. So it's really there. I'm sure it is.
What are your favorite shows on TV that you would most like to see your ads on because you like the show so much?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me what was my favorite commercial. I was going to say Ben Kress.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry, Terry. Go ahead. You were saying?
Your favorite shows on television.
My favorite show on television, generally what comes right out of this building down here, out of WHYY and HBO. And, of course, those stations that are carrying our own commercials.
Are there any times when you get a kind of certain thrill seeing your ad on a show that you especially like?
No, I think that passes after a while. It's just, at that point, it's just doing a job for you, and you're thankful for that.
You're nodding, Ben Kress.
See, when you watch it, when you do your TV commercial, they have a playback. Let's say I cut 7 or 8 commercials over at Channel 6. Those commercials, when you finish on your 10-second run, the playback has to be approved by time and by you, of course. Because not only are you acting as the writer, you're acting as your director, and you have a producer and an engineer on top. I find out that, as Aaron would say, if it's on, you don't look for them. Personally, you've seen it, and you want to hear what the public has to relate to you. As far as favorite shows, each TV station has a listening audience, which you pay the price of the listening audience in that particular segment. We're pretty lucky. We have manufacturers who augment price by the business we do, and we call it co-op advertising. We have a lot of entertainment people in our business. We're full of fashion. We love fashion. People that won't buy one suit a year or one sport coat a year, and these people are the show people in our segment. And if we get a group, they want to see, like on 10, you have a new show called Entertainment. It's all about the stars. And at 11:30, you have Mr. Carson and then Letterman and all of them. The people we get are show people, and that's the type of segments I like our particular ads to run in. to hit that type of audience.
You had chosen, for at least a while anyways, the Today Show as a place to have your ads, right?
Well, for pretty much the same reason. Pretty much the same reason. You have a wide, the shotgun effect. Johnny Carson draws a very, very large audience. And I don't think we could go wrong with it. No way.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about what it's like when you make commercials for your own business and how that affects not only your business, but your own image. And I have two guests with me who are well-known on television for their commercials. Just speaking was Aaron Levin of Aaron Levin Galleries, and also with me is Ben Crass of Crass Brothers. And what do you think of the difference of as being between UHF and VHF? I think people assume that all the locally made commercials are really done for UHF television.
Most people feel that if they watch a movie,
yeah,
you're on a UHF stance. But if you go into a live show or even a what we call a number one show, 3, 6, or 10, which is the majors, they go for more of the top new shows that are coming forth. When you're coming to a new era of time, all these shows coming forth right now, now this is fall, they're going to go for the top shows that's coming, and they want to witness, I don't know if it's Dynasty or if it's Hill Blues or stuff like that. They're going to watch that. Then at night, of course, we get into 11:30. If they don't want to watch Mr. Carson or Fantasy or all of that, they'll go into the movie, like 29 and 48 and 17 has to offer, or even sports. So the UHF are more of the movie type, and the majors, of course, that has the biggest portion of the people is on the 3, 6, and 10.
I don't believe you can do without any of them. It's a cross-section. Each has its own niche, but if you're going to cover the market, every station in the area, in the geographical area, is important to you, and you cater. You do. You cater. You want all of them, no question about it.
Has it changed your self-image at all?
Gee, I've never asked myself that question. Yes, I think I've become more relaxed, much more relaxed, whereas before I would have been much more uptight about what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. I think I'm a lot more relaxed now because of it.
Well, because it's given you more status?
Perhaps confidence, status. I don't know how to, I'd have to think about it. You know, you're posing things, questions I've never really given much thought to, but they're interesting. They're very, very, very good questions, Terry. I do think that it does have a very definite effect on you as an individual, and I think it's you're more aware of self. And if you don't spend that much time involved with yourself, this gives it a whole new dimension. Yes, I must agree.
Did it change your self-image, Ben Crass?
I was always in the show business.
Really?
So,
were you?
I used to record with Cameo Parkway. At that time, it was Chubby Checker and Bobby Rydell. And then after that, I owned a record company, which right now is Philadelphia International, of course, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. And we had, you know, I owned the Intruders, which is a group that made million-seller records, gold records. And I had a couple of biggies myself, thank God, you know. And I always was in public eye with show business. So going into, then, of course, radio was nothing to it. But going to television, of course, was the biggest plateau in the advertising gimmick of everything that I had in my lifespan to reach the public. And the public, I feel today, reaches me. It's a happy, happy marriage, one way and the other way. It's good.
Yeah, every city has the people who do the local commercials on it for clothes and galleries and used cars and food stores and whatnot. And sometimes the commercials are known as being very, very kind of crude and kind of embarrassing, and it's felt that the people don't know that they look ludicrous and are making fools of themselves. I think both of you have a certain amount of irony and showbiz in the commercials. Do people ever make fun of you, though, for doing it?
I have had people raise the devil with me. I can remember one letter that I received at one time asking me to please remove my commercial. But I don't think in anything you're going to take and satisfy everybody. That's a totally impossible thing to do. What we are doing, we're reaching people. People are coming out to see us. And the bottom line looks good, and I certainly can't object to that. As far as myself personally, do I feel hurt about it? Does it bother me? No, not really. I've had some things said about the gallery on a number of occasions. I think I can remember one time a few years ago, Philadelphia Magazine did a number on us. It was absolutely beautiful. They literally tore into the gallery. After that magazine came out, I think we had the best 2 to 3 months we had ever enjoyed in that place. So what you find, if people are going to write about you, either positively or negatively, the listening and reading audience are smart enough to want to come out and see for themselves. And if that's what's happening, it's going to benefit you. So for that reason, I never really care much anymore what anybody says.
Congrats. Your commercials are obviously really showbiz, and but
things weren't always this easy. You know that when I first started, which was, 12, 15 years ago, static was prevalent. I mean, I got more static, I think, than anybody in show business on either in TV or radio. I got hit below the belt so many times that it's just impossible to tell these things. But as time grew and the people, the audience, grew to know, first of all, the elderly people, that was a no-no. But the what we call the middle, you know, young to middle, they reached it more than the average. And little by little, the scope and the hemisphere of this point of pitching got to get into the act. And they start reading and reaching and hearing what I had to say. And it's got to be fun. It's got to be fun to do them as well as fun to hear them. Everybody's, you know, they're repeating them often enough that it must be something you're doing right. No, like Aaron said, you can't reach everybody. You can't love everybody. You can't hate everybody. You got a certain amount is your greatest success in life is reach the multitude. The multitude is the people who spend. The multitude is the people that enjoy sarcasm. That's a few you'll have everywhere in life. But they're minors. They're not majors in your lifespan. And in our store, in our business relations, in my work I do, I find that people are just genuinely great. Seriously, I'm not pitching right now. I'm telling you the facts. It's magnificent to see what a magnificent piece of work people are. And I'm overwhelmed.
I want to thank you both for telling us about your TV commercials and how they've affected you. We've been talking about what it's like when you do a commercial for your own business and how that affects not only the business but how that affects you and the way people see you and treat you. And with me has been Ben Crass, who does the Crass Brothers commercials, and Aaron Levin, who does his Aaron Levin Galleries commercials. And I want to thank you again both very much for being with us.
Our pleasure.
Welcome.
It's 4 minutes to 5, and this is 91 FM. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. And before we do that, let me tell you what's happening Monday afternoon on Fresh Air. At 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Jeffrey Hart, who's the senior editor of the conservative magazine National Review, and he's written a new book about the 50s called When the Going Was Good, American Life in the 50s. That will be at about 2 o'clock. We expect we'll open up the phones when he joins us. At about 2:40, we'll be joined by one of the Ms. Magazine editors, Robin Morgan, and she'll be discussing her new book, The Anatomy of Freedom, Feminism, Physics, and Global Politics. So that will be at about 2:40. At about 3:40, Judy Stein will review museum and gallery shows around town. And at 4 o'clock, we continue our tailor-made piano series, Billy Taylor's Jazz History Program, and the subject will be pre-bop, the music of Art Tatum, Milt Buckner, Nat King Cole, and others. So I hope you can join us Monday afternoon. Bill Van Wert contributed to today's show. Paul Keller was the technical director. Maeve McGoran's the production assistant. Danny Miller, the associate producer. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good weekend. This is WUHY FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Financial support for this program is provided by the National Public Radio News and Information Fund. Contributors to this fund include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust, RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company, and for Midwestern coverage, the Joyce Foundation. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Leslie Breeding.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
They have a saying here, if you is a good nigga, if you work good, you ain't going to jail. They tell you if you keep your feet out of the grave, we will keep you out of jail. And that's children.
The rules were clear for those who grew up black in this small Delta town in Mississippi, but a lot of those unwritten rules were broken by the end this week of the biggest trial in the town's history. Tonight on All Things Considered, crime and civil rights in Chula, Mississippi.
Also these stories, the Ku Klux Klan still recruiting and projecting a new image.
A journalist who knew the Klan from the inside says unemployment makes the Klan's job easier.
The government's report on unemployment breaks another post-depression record.
The governor's race in Illinois remains a matter of contention.
Now that elections are over, Washington faces the reality of Social Security funding problems, and today, for the first time, the program had to borrow.
In Canada, strikers have shut down Chrysler plants in six cities.
And in Dallas, drive-in movie fans try to revive their favorite fading pastime.
First, this news.
This is John Hockenberry. Another month has passed and another jobless record has been set. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported today that 10.4% of Americans are without jobs, a rise of 0.3% in October. Since the recession began last July, nearly 4 million Americans have been forced out of work. October showed rises in blue-collar unemployment, now at 15.9%, Hispanic unemployment, now at 15.2%, and white unemployment, now at 9.3%. There was improvement for black teenagers, and for blacks as a whole, unemployment unemployment was unchanged last month, standing at 20.2%. Economist Michael Evans of Evans Economics says the overall increase in joblessness follows a familiar pattern in the recession economy.
The economy continues to be very weak. There was no upturn that started in July, and therefore businesses decided that they had to start cutting back. There wasn't going to be a big boost in consumer spending. They had too many inventories, and so the only option left of them was to start laying off workers. So they started 2 months ago, they continued last month, and they will increase their layoffs through the end of the year.
Today's figures represent the highest unemployment rate since 1940. The Justice Department said today it will refuse to obey an order from a court in Los Angeles requiring that White House Counselor Edwin Meese testify at the trial of a draft resister. The White House claims executive privilege. The defendant claims the government is pursuing a policy of selective prosecution of draft non-registrants, and testimony from Meese will prove it. The judge in the case said last week he would dismiss charges if Meese did not take the stand. Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Romero said he expected that would happen, but that the government would appeal the dismissal. At 10 this morning, about 10,000 Chrysler workers walked off the job in Canada. The workers are demanding more pay. They say they're getting less than American auto workers by roughly $3 an hour. Canadian wages have been frozen since 1979, and the strike enjoys wide support among Canadians, like these workers in Windsor, Canada. And if it continues, employment in American factories will be affected. More from Paul Eisenstein in Detroit.
It won't take long for the Canadian strike to begin having an impact on this side of the border. Chrysler's U.S. and Canadian plants produce a lot of parts for each other, and that means the automaker will be cutting back or closing down many American factories. By next Monday, 6,000 U.S. workers will be laid off, and that number will grow as the walkout continues. But company chairman Lee Iacocca has warned this walkout could drive Chrysler into bankruptcy if it drags on. And industry analyst Arvid Jopi agrees.
2 weeks wouldn't hurt. A month would hurt a fair amount. 2 months would hurt immensely. In 3 months, I think that we would have to restructure Chrysler Corporation into some other kind of company.
The Canadian strike has another implication for Chrysler and the UAW. In this country, the union has agreed to continue working, with a new round of negotiations beginning next January. If the automaker is forced to eventually give in to Canadian demands, it'll make it all the more difficult to refuse American workers the wage hike they want. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Eisenstein in Detroit.
In Chicago today, an unofficial count of Tuesday's ballots led incumbent Governor Jim Thompson to declare an unofficial victory over Adlai Stevenson III. The apparent victory margin is about 9,400 votes, less than 0.3% of the 3.5 million cast. But results won't be official until November 22nd. Stevenson has not conceded, and the final decision will probably be left up to the courts. In Boston today, a new federally funded research center devoted to the study of aging was dedicated. The center will take a new look at many aspects of aging. In some respects, it represents a revolutionary change in how the medical profession views growing old. Jim Randall attended the dedication and filed this report.
The premise of the Tufts Nutrition Center is that diet can probably control aging's destructive effect on mind and body, something like drugs control disease. Here, for the first time, the effect of medication on nutrients is being monitored systematically. For the first time, there's a study of why senility is virtually unknown in some ethnic groups. For the first time, the effect of megavitamin doses is being studied by Dr. Robert Russell, who's focusing on the prevention of cataracts.
It's possible that people who take large doses, this is sort of paradoxical, of vitamin C, may actually produce changes in the lens which accelerate cataract formation.
There's something else that makes the Tufts Nutrition Center unique.
This is the one national laboratory I can think of operated by a private university for the government of the United States, which is entirely devoted to the welfare of mankind.
Tufts University President Jean Mayer, who says the goal of the Nutrition Center is to improve the quality of life so that everyone dies young, as late as possible. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Randall in Boston.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up at 1051.78, a gain of 1.56. Trading was heavy, with 96,550,000 shares changing hands, and the average price of a share was up 10 cents. I'm John Hockenberry in Washington.
For 3 days, one race in this year's election has been unresolved, the race for governor of Illinois. Today, the final figures came in, and the voters of Illinois finally know who the governor will probably be. NPR's Scott Simon prepared our report.
Let's do it.
Are we ready to go?
Yes.
No, we're not, because somebody just blew his camera.
We don't have championship sports in Illinois, but there is politics.
Here are the numbers that you all want to hear. in the race for county clerk.
The clerk of Cook County, Illinois, Stanley Cusper, did get around to reading the results from the final 200 suburban precincts, and those figures seemed to place Governor James Thompson ahead by about 9,000 votes in the unofficial tally of the contest. But those numbers shouldn't be regarded as decisive, because this election is so close that it's not about to be decided before the officially certified canvass on November 22nd, and maybe not for several months after that. Now, standing just several feet from Mr. Cusper, for example, was Alderman Edward Burke. He's a member of the Cook County Democratic Organization, that political aggregate which locals like to call the machine. Now, Mr. Burke told reporters that the unofficial totals put together by news organizations differed from those totted up by Democratic precinct workers statewide.
There would seem at this point to be a divergence, and the Democratic Party's position is that Adlai Stevenson is the winner by a slim margin.
Governor, can you tell us what it's like waiting for the outcome of your political future?
Friend, it's exciting.
What's been happening here in Illinois over the past several days is absolutely unprecedented, but it's also somehow absolutely harmonious with the rambunctious political traditions of this state. 1960 is the vintage year for many political historians. John Kennedy was trailing Richard Nixon by about 17,000 votes. Sometime after midnight, the late Mayor Richard Daley located untabulated ballots from the first ward along the Chicago River, and they added up to 23,000 votes in favor of John Kennedy. Became, because of it, President of the United States. Now, to be accurate as well as gracious, no criminal indictments ever resulted from that election, despite the allegations, and there were other reports suggesting that Republican forces in downstate Illinois had been equally imaginative in extending the electoral franchise to the fictitious and deceased. But the fable of Chicago politics persists, and it might have been on the mind of Governor Thompson last night when he spoke with reporters about 15 Chicago precincts which were located and counted 2 days after the election.
All I know is that I've lived in this city all my life and I've seen about everything. It just strikes me as strange that 15 precincts which were not there before suddenly turn up.
But on an ABC television appearance late last night, Adlai Stevenson said that the inferences of electoral misconduct had been greatly exaggerated.
The U.S. attorney, to the contrary, has said that he has no evidence of such dishonesty in Cook County. Whoever gets inaugurated as governor could be inaugurated with a majority of as little as 0.07%.
Which is near to where it stands right now, less than a single vote's difference per precinct. Now, whichever candidate is shown to be losing at the official canvass on November 22nd can begin the process of making the case for a recount. But the law on that does not make the proposition easy. A panel of three judges would be appointed by the state Supreme Court, and the law they'll be looking at states that a recount can be ordered only when there's reasonable cause to suppose that the election has been injured by fraud. Now, what's intriguing about that is that Adlai Stevenson, while he was leading last night, was insisting publicly that the count throughout the state had been essentially honest. But if he's shown by the official canvass to be behind Governor Thompson still by even just a smattering of votes, he'll have to advance the argument that election fraud has occurred throughout the state if he is to be granted a recount.
We will be at the canvass. They will be at the canvass. You will be at the canvass. And we'll see what the canvass shows.
Governor, early tonight, Governor Thompson came to his campaign headquarters, and he still declined to claim a victory for himself. Even following the canvass and a possible recount of the ballots, court suits could delay the official determination of a governor by several months. A Democratic Party official told us on the telephone, "You know, when this is over, I'm going to pile up all the polls and all the ballots and burn them. And when the white smoke rises, we can all point and say, yes, we have a governor." This is Scott Simon reporting. Today, the Social Security system had to rob Peter to pay Paul. The Old Age and Survivors Fund, that's the basic pension fund, was forced to borrow money from the disability fund in order to pay its bills. Now that the election's over, the Social Security problem will once again be before Congress. And yesterday, Republican Senate Finance Committee Chairman Robert Dole tried to throw the onus for a solution firmly into the Democrats' corner. NPR's Cokie Roberts is here with us to talk about Social Security. Cokie, what happens next?
Well, as you know, Noah, throughout the campaign, Republicans kept saying we have to wait for the bipartisan commission that the president has established to deal with Social Security to make its report before we have any solutions. That commission was actually supposed to make a report probably next week. They now think it'll be a little bit later, but sometime before the end of the year. What Senator Dole was saying is the commission shouldn't make any recommendation at all until the Democrats come up with some sort of solutions of their own. The reason he was doing that is because Democrats went up and down the country throughout this election saying that the Republicans were out to get Social Security, and Democratic challengers were able to say in district after district accurately that the Republican House incumbent had voted to cut Social Security.